We're going through the book of Daniel. The overall lesson in the book is God rules in the kingdoms of men. He rules over all. He rules supreme. This is brought out to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 of Daniel, when Nebuchadnezzar has his second dream or second series of dreams, that God rules completely over everything, including all the Gentile nations, Israel, everyone. In chapter 1 of Daniel, we see the four Jewish lads, descendants of Hezekiah, taken into Babylonian captivity. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And there is an important scripture that is found in chapter 1 that they are tasked with the responsibility of eating the king's delicacies and drinking the king's wine. I'm sure this was not something that was just picked off the street. This is the king's delicacy, so something must have been something was wrong with it. We don't know exactly what. Was it unclean or something else? We don't know. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. He purposed in his heart. And that is not just for Daniel, but also for the three cousins that came into captivity with him. Chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, a series of dreams about four empires, kingdoms, starting with Babylon, going down to Rome. Then in chapter 3, the three cousins of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their Babylonian names, were threatened with being thrown into the fiery furnace if they did not bow down to the image Nebuchadnezzar had built. They refused to because they had purposed in their hearts. Chapter 4, we have this dream of Nebuchadnezzar as he sees this tree growing up into heaven. And there's a band of iron wrapped around this tree, and it is going to be cut down 7 times or 7 years. Is what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. He became a beast for 7 years until he came to the point where he recognized God rules in the kingdoms of men. His grandson, Belshazzar, in chapter 5, saw the handwriting on the wall, the Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. It is about the fall of Babylon, but not only the fall of Babylon, but also his death. Chapter 6, Daniel is put in the lion's den. He purposed in his heart that he would not change from a habit that he was accustomed to, of praying to God. And then in chapter 7, which we dealt with last time, Daniel has the dream, and it is a dream of four beasts. The beasts are also Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, same as what is found in chapter 2. But in chapter 7, there is also another horn that is mentioned. I want to go there in Daniel chapter 7. It is the little horn, the little horn. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 8, it's introduced. It says, I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out of by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. The interpretation of this fourth beast and this little horn is brought out beginning in verse 20, as it says, and then the 10 horns that were on the head of this fourth beast and the other horn, which came up, before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows, I was watching. And the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Whatever persecution, whenever it starts, is going to continue all the way down to the time when Christ returns. Verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from his kingdom. And another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law, then the saints shall be given into his hand for time, times, and half time. Reading this in chapter 7, several things are brought out about this little horn. Little horn, one, is a kingdom. It's a kingdom in verse 24. The 10 horns are 10 kings, and 10 kings are over 10 kingdoms. Who shall arise from this kingdom? Another horn shall rise up. It's a king over a kingdom. Two, this little horn uproots three horns or three kingdoms. Three, this little horn persecutes the saints, persecutes the people of God. Four, the little horn blasphemes God, speaks pompous words against God. And five, the little horn thinks to change times and law. Thinks to change times and law. This is the outline for the message today. As we start, first of all, with number one, the little horn is a kingdom. So we reread already verse 24. A horn is a king, a kingdom. And he comes up during this fourth beast of the Roman kingdom. Who is it? What is it? Secondly, it uproots three horns, or three kings, or three kingdoms of this Roman kingdom or empire. Who did it? Who did it? I want to go back to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13, as it gives us some context of understanding what is going on here. I'm going to start in verse 1 of Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13, beginning with verse 1. It says, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth was like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority." Now, this is a combination of all the beasts in Daniel chapter 7. I'm bringing up the screen once again. Daniel 2 is Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Nebuchadnezzar's dream is that of a man from the head of gold down to the feet of partly of clay and of iron. You find that on the left side of the screen. Head of gold, Babylon. The chest of silver, Medo-Persia. Belly of bronze, Greece. Legs of iron, Rome. In Daniel chapter 7, we have four beasts. The first beast is a lion. It has wings, but it's a lion. It has one head. The second beast is the bear, Medo-Persia. It has one head. The third beast is Greece. It has four heads. It is a four-headed leopard. The fourth beast is Rome. It has one head and 10 horns. This is all combined in the second row of the Revelation 13 beast. The Revelation 13 beast has seven heads and 10 horns. Where are the 10 horns? On the seventh head. On the seventh head. Now, I'm going to bring out here a few other things before we leave this particular chart that I've created. Verse 3. It says, "And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast." The only empire to die and come back to life again was the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire. I cited this before going through the Bible study on the book of Daniel several years ago. I had a professor who wrote a paper at Ambassador College, What Constitutes the Resurrection of the Roman Empire? He says various factors, paramount among which must be a desire by the resurging power to imitate the Roman system and to actually look on itself as either a continuation or a revival of Rome. He mentions Charlemagne, for example, who then was crowned 800 AD, December 25th, I think it was. Charlemagne, for example, actually minted coins with the inscription, Empire Restored. Fascinating to look at the history of these particular rulerships down through time. But then as the paper coming to a conclusion, it mentions this. It says the powers of the Vandals, the Heruli, and Ostrogoths were all independent states that continued to perpetuate the Roman system after the original empire itself had collapsed. They perpetuated the Roman system. This is what you find with these revivals, these coming back to life again. It is still Rome. It is the Roman system. So when you look then at the bottom of this chart, you have on the left column, Vandals, Heruli, Ostrogoths. These were barbarians, but they perpetuated the Roman system. The right column are leaders with a strong to moderate to weak religious alliance. There is religion attached to the seven on the right. And this is indicated as we, as I'm going to go away from this chart, that last graph there, that last pictorial of Revelation chapter 17, we'll come to that. That is where this little horn is actually riding on the beast, which has seven heads and 10 horns. I'll explain that later. We're going to go to the end of Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13, we will now see the connection, the religious connection. Revelation 13, beginning with verse 11. He says, then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. This little horn that has two horns, the indication is when you look at it in the context, it looks like a lamb. It looks like the lamb that is described in the book of Revelation, Jesus Christ. But it is empowered by the dragon. The dragon is Satan, the devil. And so verse 12, it says, and he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. Verse 15, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or in their foreheads. And without that mark, you will be susceptible to being exterminated. The beast at the beginning of chapter 13 of Revelation is a civil government. The beast here at the end of chapter 13 is a religious government in the fourth kingdom of Rome. Who is it? It is a Roman church because it looks like the Lamb, but it is powered by the dragon. What is the image? Image is a copy. It's a representation, a model, a semblance, counterpart, likeness. Cited this before from The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon. He says this, towards the end of the second century, the churches of Greece and Asia adopted the useful institutions of provincial synods. And they may justly be supposed to have borrowed the motto, a copy, if you will, of the representative council from the celebrated examples of their own country. And the Catholic Church soon assumed the form and acquired the strength of a great federative republic. The Roman Church, the Roman Catholic Church, is the little horn. The church uprooted three, the Vandals, the Heruli, the Ostrogoths. They were instrumental in the overthrow of these three. The history of this is brought out in the primary text we use at Ambassador College in Western Civilization, an Encyclopedia of World History by William Langer. William Langer. I still have the notes of Dr. Hay, who was going through and bringing out this in detail, what is brought out in William Langer's Encyclopedia of World History about the three horns, the Vandals, the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, their ascendancy to power, and how the Catholic Church was instrumental in their overthrow. Even though they perpetuated the Roman form of government, they angered the church because they adopted Arianism. Arianism perpetuates the idea that Jesus Christ was a created being. But we're getting into this Gnostic ideas. Christ was a created being. Only God was infinite. Christ wasn't. The church did not uphold that idea, even though Arius was a bishop. They did not. They defended Athanasius, and Athanasius said that not only was the Father divine, not only was Christ divine, but the Holy Spirit was as well. The Holy Spirit. There were three divine beings. And so the church, because the barbarians would not submit to that belief, Trinity, they now were being helped. They helped the Romans overthrow these barbarians. I'm going to move now over to Revelation chapter 17. And here in Revelation 17, I'm going to combine the next two traits in Daniel 7 of the little horn. Three, persecution of the saints. Four, blaspheming God. Revelation chapter 17, beginning with verse 1. It says, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. That is predicated upon something done in history. This is figurative language, but it actually happened in history. She committed whoredoms with the kings of the earth, symbolically. In return, they helped her to further the religion. Hold it here in Revelation chapter 17. We're going back to the minor prophet, Nahum. has always struck when our tour guide, when we were over in Israel, and we were up on the Sea of Galilee, and the northern part of it, as most would, we would pronounce the word Capernaum, is the house of Nahum. He said Capernaum. I don't know if I even engaged him in conversation. You mean the Hebrew pronunciation of that prophet is Nahum? Nahum. Nahum, I'll say Nahum then. Nahum, this is right in the middle of the minor prophets, is the beginning of the last six minor prophets, chapter 3, verse 4. The book is dealing with the fall of Assyria. I'm dealing with a lot of history today. You can understand my fascination. I never did like history in the past, but until I went to Ambassador College, and ancient history just fascinated me. But this book here is about the fall of Assyria. Assyria is linked historically to Babylon. But notice what it says here in Nahum chapter 3, verse 4. Because of the multitude of harlotries, of the seductive harlot, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations through her harlotries and families through her sorceries. Sounds like Revelation 17. I cite an extra biblical source, a Greek historian by the name of Herodotus, 5th century BC. Now, he is writing about Rome primarily, but the Roman kingdom did not start until 31 AD, even though Rome itself as a city was founded back in 753 BC. Herodotus is writing some 300 years after Rome, the city, was founded. In book 1, section 199, Herodotus says this: the Babylonians have one most shameful custom. Every woman born in the country must once in her life go and sit down in the precinct of Venus and there consort with a stranger. Sounds like Revelation 17, 1 to 2. This is how Babylonian religion was spreaded back in ancient times, because they would come to a particular religious establishment and commit fornication with women who were ordered to go to the precinct, go to this religious establishment and commit fornication with those who come. This is how it spread, and I will allude to its origin here shortly, but I want to go back to Revelation 17. Revelation 17, the end of verse 1 again says, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Verse 3, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. With the diagram that I had shown before, this particular beast has seven heads and 10 horns, but the woman of the fourth Roman Empire beast is riding on top of this one. This would be the collaboration between the Roman system, religious, and the Roman government, civil, from Justinian down to the last king, last beast. Continuing, verse 9 of Revelation 17. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. We looked at the wording here in verse 10 in the past, in which it says five had fallen. Five kingdoms had fallen. Those five kingdoms starting with Justinian, Charlemagne, Otto, Charles the Great, and Napoleon. One is Garibaldi back in the 1800s, but his empire extended down to Mussolini. Is it then? When the book of Daniel says, the angel tells Daniel, seal this until the time of the end. Many will go to and fro. At which point in time the book opens. Prophets have always had this desire to understand what it is they're writing about. Daniel's no exception. Was then this book beginning to be opened 100 years ago when God started working with a man from Iowa? Herbert W. Armstrong. One is yet to come. One is yet to come. He will only continue a short time. Then verse 12, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no power as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they shall give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For he is Lord of lords, King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. It is further brought out in chapter 19 of Revelation, that is Jesus Christ. These 10 kings, we're dealing with an exact number, or we're dealing with just kind of a representation of a group of people. They will make war against Jesus Christ and will be defeated. This is what Mr. Armstrong came to understand, because initially he thought in Daniel 2, the beast with the 10 toes, those were the 10 resurrections of the Roman Empire. But those 10 toes are destroyed by the stone cut out of the mountains without hands. That happens when Christ returns. He realizes Revelation 17 is referring to Daniel chapter 2. The 10 kings that are destroyed by Jesus Christ. They are the final resurrection of the Roman Empire. They will give their power to the beast. Collective, individual, whatever it is, they will be overcome, overwhelmed when Christ returns. Now, let's go back over here to the book of Isaiah. Hold your place here in Revelation 17 again. Don't unleash that. If you've got a hard copy of the Bible, I'm going to come back to Revelation 17. I'm going to go to Isaiah 47. Isaiah chapter 47. We're dealing now with this little horn that persecutes the saints, blasphemes the name of God. Isaiah 47, beginning with verse 1. It says, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate, virgin daughter. Figurative language, with no doubt. Is it now referring to this religion that has a proclamation of the Lamb, but is powered by the dragon? She claims to be the religion of God. She claims to be the church of the Lamb, Jesus Christ, using the name of Christ, Christianity, quote unquote. But her beliefs are nothing but paganism of Babylon, As we will see, it is the religion of Satan. I'm not going to go into the details of the history of this. Back in Genesis chapter 10, you can hold it in Isaiah 47 if you want to go there, to Genesis 10. We find the descendants of Noah, his three sons, Japheth, Ham, and Shem. In Genesis chapter 10, verse 8, we're coming now to one of the descendants of Ham, Cush. It says, Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. One paraphrase, against the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Erech, Akkad, Calneh, in the land of Shinar. From that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh. That's why even the book of Nahum can be tied in with Babylon. But the beginning of his kingdom, Babel, it is described in chapter 11 of Genesis. And what do we find in Genesis? The Tower of Babel, in which they are building this tower that reaches up to heaven, like the dream of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4, so that they would not be destroyed again. But God came down and he confounded their language because they were all of one language, and he called it Babel. One of the apps that you have today, B-A-B-B-E-L, for translation purposes. And the reason God did it is because they were so close to doing things that he did not want them to do. He knew that ultimately what would happen, they would destroy themselves because they were being powered by Satan. So he confounded their language. Now let me bring out another Greek historian. Got rid of so many books when we moved from Maryland, hundreds and hundreds. Certain ones, they were classics to me, and I kept, don't know how long I'll keep them, because at some point in time in the future, I'll even get rid of these. This is the first century Greek historian, first century BC, Diodorus Siculus. In book one, chapter 21, section 2-3, he talks about the death of Nimrod. He uses the Egyptian name of Nimrod, Osiris. Osiris. He says this, when Osiris, or Nimrod, was ruling over Egypt as its lawful king, he was murdered by his brother Typhon. Inject a point here. Dr. Hay at one point, and never did follow up on this because so many other things were going on. Dr. Hay at one point believed that Typhon was the last son of Noah, Shem, that it was Shem who was responsible for killing Nimrod. Don't know that for sure. That was just his explanation, his comment that he made at one point that I remember. He says, Typhon then divided the body of the slain man into 26 pieces and gave one portion to each of the band of murderers, since he wanted all of them to share in the pollution and felt that in this way he would have in them steadfast supporters and defenders of his rule. But the rebellion by Nimrod continued after his death. Secretly, it continued by his wife, Semiramis. Her Egyptian name, Isis. It's just coincidence that we have a group today. They use the acronym Islamic State, but it is ISIS. Is the coincidence by spiritual design, not so much by God, but by Satan. Semiramis or ISIS. We find a detailed description of what she did in the second book of Diodorus. She went underground, and after the death of her husband, she organized the most popular religion for the last 4,000 years. Back then, it was the Babylonian mystery religion. We'll see this name in Revelation 17. But today, it is Christianity. I say quote unquote. Her doctrines were, back then, Nimrod was born on the winter solstice. Today, the leader was born December 25th, Christmas. Back then, women must mourn every year because of Nimrod's death. Ezekiel 8, verse 14 indicates it. Today, Lent, 40 days of mourning. Back then, Nimrod was resurrected in the spring. Today, the leader comes up Easter. Easter. Back then, Nimrod was the mighty hunter, the warrior, Roman name Lupercalia. Today, Valentine. Valentine. Back then, Nimrod was head of a trio. Nimrod, Semiramis, and her son, Horus. Convolution of all of this, that when Nimrod came back to life, he came back through the sun, Horus. But it was the trio. Today, Trinity. And if you do not subscribe to it back then, you're banished. The same today, you're a cult. You're a cult. I cite a book written over 100 years ago, Pagan and Christian Creeds by Edward Carpenter. Mr. Carpenter says this, the Christian church, and I put it in quotation marks, has kept itself severely apart from discussions of heathenism, taking the stand that it, the church, represents a unique and divine revelation and has persuaded mankind of this to such a degree that few people nowadays realize that it is sprung from just the same root as paganism and that it shares by far, for the most part, of its doctrines and rites with the latter. It's a bold statement that he brings out and he shows the connections between them. There's a connection between the Babylonian religion and the religion today masquerading as Christianity. Let me go back to Isaiah 47. Isaiah 47, and pick it up. Isaiah 47, verse 2, he says, take the millstone, grind meal, remove your veil, take off the skirt, uncover the thighs, pass through the rivers, get ready to work, in other words. You're going to work like a slave after living such a delicate, charmed life that you have for centuries. Verse 3, your nakedness shall be uncovered. Yes, your shame will be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will not arbitrate with a man. Nobody will interfere with me. I rule. I've only allowed you to be in existence, but I rule. Verse 4, as for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel, sit in silence and go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no longer be called the Lady of Kingdoms, the Mother of Kingdoms, the, Revelation 17, Whore of Kingdoms. I was angry with my people. I have profaned my inheritance and given them into your hand. You showed them no mercy. On the elderly, you laid your yoke very heavy. God allowed Israel to be divided into two, northern and southern. Who took over the northern area? Assyria. Who's responsible for Assyria? Nimrod. Who took over the southern area? Judah? Babylon. There is a connection. There is a connection. But it lays a yoke, a very heavy yoke. What is that yoke? Makes me wonder, and I just have to just think, my own AJ thinking. When Nebuchadnezzar invaded Jerusalem, did he first consult with the Chaldeans, the magicians, the astrologers and sorcerers about the attack of Judah? Now, he's the king. He can do whatever he wants to. But there is a tendency to consult with those in the area of religion first. Did he? Fast forward to the end. When we have great tribulation, who is responsible for those who are going to be isolated, persecuted, people of God? Who's responsible for their persecution? The church. With the mark of the beast? The church. They are in cahoots with the religion and the government, civil government, to persecute the church. So he says, verse 7, and you said, I shall be a lady forever. I'm the eternal city. I'm the eternal church. I'm the eternal kingdom. So that you did not take these things to heart, nor remember the latter end of them. She didn't believe that she wouldn't last forever. Therefore, hear this now, you who are given to pleasures, who dwell securely or confidently, who say in your heart, I am, and there is no one else beside me. I am. God's name. God's name. Tetragrammaton. YHVH. It's found in chapters 45 and chapter 46. I am. Is it? Is it possible that the use of certain names by the little horn are the reason for the blasphemy? Partially, Reverend, Most Holy Reverend, Most Right Reverend, Holy Father, Most Holy Father. So God says they're going to come to destruction in a moment, in verses 9 to 11. Let me move back here to pick this pace up. Chapter 17 of Revelation. Revelation chapter 17. And pick it up now with verse 4. Revelation 17, verse 4, it says, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup of abominations and the filthiness of her fornications. You can kind of go off on a tangent on a number of these terms and expressions in verse 4. Scarlet, you find that is associated with wealth and quality, but is also associated with harlotry and sin. Golden cup, you find this even cited back in Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 7. The golden cup. The golden cup, the nations are going to drink wine from this golden cup, and they're going to become deranged from this golden cup. The wine in this golden cup is going to cause them to now stumble. So verse 5, and on her forehead, a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. All of this is an abomination to God. It is a continuation of the abomination that started Genesis 11 and continues down till today. And she is the mother of harlots. Her harlot daughters drink from the same cup. Some differences, but the major ones. Nimrod, winter solstice. The leader today, Christmas. Nimrod, spring solstice, resurrection. Today, Easter. Nimrod, part of the Trinity, trio. Today, that doctrine is the primary doctrine in Christianity. You don't believe in it, you're a cult. I go over here, or verse 6 before I do. Verse 6 says, and I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Once she has achieved the dominance, and she did it back in the early years after the church started, she has tried to stifle the truth. That's what it says of Antiochus in Daniel chapter 8. He cast truth to the ground. That's what they were trying to do. Let me go now to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. As I consider now the last point of the little horn. Last point of the little horn of Daniel chapter 7 is that she thinks to change laws. She thinks to change laws. The church in Thessalonica is being troubled by people who do not know God, but will be punished. That's in chapter 1. And then we come to chapter 2, we find the trouble. 2 Thessalonians 2, it says, now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken of mind or troubled either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if it was from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. Two things that he brings out here, Paul brings up, that are to occur before the return of Jesus Christ. One, a falling away. Two, the man of sin is revealed. The falling away, number one, that is going to lead in a sense to the return of Jesus Christ, the falling away from what? The Greek word for falling away, apostasia, from which we get the word apostasy. And when you look at the context, the falling away or the apostasy is from the truth. From the truth. Drop down, verse 9. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of whom? Satan. With all power, signs, and lying wonders. Satan is behind the man of sin, and I might add the falling away. He is behind it, and I might add he's behind the little horn. The little horn. We too often forget being, the force that is at work behind all that goes on. God allows it. God allows it. We look at what happened back in the last century, and we start pointing fingers, and we still can point fingers. God allows it. But it's like God has opened up the hedge around the church to let Satan in. And is trying to disassociate us from the truth. Verse 10. And with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, present progressive, who are perishing, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. We cannot compromise with the truth. Daniel purposed in his heart so that when the threat came of lions, didn't matter. The threat came of a fiery furnace, it didn't matter. The threat comes of a mark of the beast, it doesn't matter. It is in the heart. The purpose of God's miracles is to open the door to lead God's people to the truth. The purpose of these signs and wonders is to lead people away from the truth into lies. And especially those who do not have and are holding on to a love of the truth. This is where the apostasy comes in. They are falling away from the truth. Verse 11, and for this reason, God will send them strong delusions that they should believe the lie. A person can so resist the truth that he finally becomes so deluded he'll believe a lie. And if you listen to a lie long enough, you know what you think? It is the truth. It is the truth. It's hard to even think of individuals for years who understood about God, about Jesus Christ, as they let it go. And now we talk about God the Father, the Son, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. Said, they did not keep it purposed in their heart. What is this lie God is going to allow? It doesn't say. Whatever it is very convincing. So verse 12, he says that they all may be condemned who do not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. That's where Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 4 that we read earlier comes in. And what Herodotus was bringing out, that they have consorts, going to different temples, commit whoredoms. Two reasons of the lie is accepted, signs and wonders. Fatima, Guadalupe, Medjugorje. And then an appeal to sin. You can see how Nahum 3 can fit in and why she is referred to as a whore. There is something that is appealing to her. Man of sin is brought out beginning in verse 4. He opposes and exalts himself of all who call God, that is worship. He sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. We've looked at this man individually, historically, as Simon the magician, Simon Magus. But he starts a line of individuals who have been in that position where they have risen up to the level of God. And that's why it is called a mystery of lawlessness. They're against the law. I bring out a couple of other sources as I start wrapping this up. One that we have used consistently through the years, Jesse Hurlbut, Story of the Christian Church. He says about the first century, we name the last generation of the first century from 68 to 100 AD, some go beyond that, the Age of Shadows, partly because of the gloom of persecution was over the church, but more especially because of all periods in the history, it is the one about which we know the least. We have no longer the clear light of the book of Acts to guide us, and no author of that age has filled the blank in the history. We would like to read of the later works of such helpers of St. Paul as Timothy, Apollos, Titus, but all these and St. Paul's other friends drop out of the record at his death. Only one we've got is John and maybe Titus, not Titus, Philemon. Not Philemon. Philemon, yes. His brother, the last one before the book of Revelation. These writers, we don't have a lot. Primarily
John. And as Herbert says, for 50 years after St. Paul's life, a curtain hangs over the church through which we strive vainly to look. And when at last it rises around 120 AD, with the writings of the earliest church fathers, we find a church in many aspects very different from the days of St. Peter and St. Paul. And then later on in the book, he says, the forms and ceremonies of paganism gradually crept into the worship. Just this carpenter said. Some of the old heathen feasts became church festivals with a change of name and worship. Christmas, Easter, Lent. This continued on down throughout history to the return of Jesus Christ. Hurlbut says this in one particular example. On page 45, the Lord's Day was generally observed, though not with the strictness as a day absolutely set apart. This is Sunday. As long as the church was mainly Jewish, the Hebrew Sabbath was kept. Why that adjective? That descriptor? But when it became increasingly Gentile, the first day gradually took the place of the seventh. On whose authority? Who would deign to claim authority to change God's Sabbath? The church. The church. Last book that I cite from, I picked up years ago, one of those original copies of the book, copywritten in 1917. These are some of these old dusty books that, but they serve a purpose for me at the time. You might even be able to look some of this stuff up today. It is entitled Faith of Our Fathers by James Cardinal Gibbons, Archbishop of Baltimore in the late 19th to the early 20th century. Chapter 8 is entitled The Church and the Bible. He mentions that the Bible is a competent guide. And a competent guide must have three characteristics. First, a complete guide of salvation must be within the reach of every inquirer after the truth. Guide to salvation. Okay. Second, a competent religious guide must be clear and intelligible to all, so that everyone may fully understand the true meaning of the instructions it contains. Well, with a little help, you can. Third, a rule of faith or a competent guide to heaven, problem right there, must be able to instruct in all the truths necessary for salvation. Now, the scriptures alone do not contain all the truths which a Christian is bound to believe. Nor do they explicitly enjoin all the duties which he is obliged to practice. Not to mention other examples, is it not every Christian obliged to sanctify Sunday and to abstain on that day from unnecessary servile work? Is not the observance of this law among the most prominent of our sacred duties? But you may read the Bible from... This is a Catholic cardinal. You may read the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, and you will not find a single line authorizing the sanctification of Sunday. The scriptures enforce the religious observance of Saturday, a day
which we never sanctify. Because it was the church that changed, thought to change the law from Saturday to Sunday. And her daughters continue to follow. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. And so must we as we approach the end of time.